welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program.
I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times.
This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and welcome to quite a different program in the award-winning series of Listen to Older Voices. It'd be fair to say we've covered and investigated most of the major periods of Australia's history in the past 100 years. In this series of three programs, we feature the story of Robert Lloyd, and in doing so, we start to unravel some of the amazing developments of music in Australia that came from the baby boomer generation, a period that we haven't spent so much time in. A Renaissance man, Robert Lloyd sees little division between his work as a composer, songwriter, teacher, writer, actor, poet, and public speaker. His current creative vision includes writing music, words, and performing music that reflects on the state of the world we live in and the process of finding meaning in our daily life. Now, here I am speaking with Robert as he goes back to the beginning. Robert, it'd be fair to say that you are a genuine baby boomer, wouldn't it?
I think I am. That's the term that people use now. And I'm not so big on labelling things, but yes, I think I'm a baby boomer.
That's something I'd like to explore a little bit later on, but to start with, I'd like to take you back as early as you can recall. Maybe we could start by finding out when you were born and whereabouts were you born?
I'm an Adelaide boy, and I was born in Adelaide in May 1948.
What would be your earliest recollection?
It's hard to know because I've recently, by working on a documentary, been looking at old photos, and there's a photo I have of me in a pram in a sunny day in Adelaide, and I keep thinking that's my oldest recollection, but it's just a photo, so I don't really know.
What was life like for you as a young boy growing up in Adelaide?
The thing that I do really remember is we lived opposite a huge paddock with nothing in it, and which eventually turned into this very large cemetery. So I seem to have a feeling of like almost growing up in the West, you know, like as in the West of America. Really dusty, hot, blazing hot days with dust around and a real sense of space and the sense of possibility, which I think was wonderful. I grew up in a pretty ordinary suburb called Enfield, but always this sense of like you could hop on your horse or hop on your bike and ride for a long way, and there was this real sense of space and opportunity, and you'd go a long way. You could really surge off into the future or the unknown.
So for a kid with an imagination, it would be really good. You could really let your imagination run wild.
I think I did. I think I did. I did some incredible things. Like my father built me a little cubby house, and my father was quite a perfectionist, so he built this amazing, I must have had the best cubby house in the neighborhood, and it was, you know, you could stand up in it, and I thought I was like in the Alamo, you know. I was like Davy Crockett, you know, fighting off the other guys at the Alamo. But there was this incredible sense of like I was this sort of, you know, loner cowboy, you know, fighting the other people off. That sort of manifested sometimes in having a little BB gun and shooting at the chooks in the backyard of the people across the in the neighborhood who we didn't like. They were called the Hendersons, you know. We didn't like them so much.
Did you have any brothers and sisters to play with?
I did. I had an older sister, Lynn, who's a visual artist, and she still lives in Adelaide. And I have a brother, Peter, who's an arts administrator guy, and he now lives in Port Macquarie.
Were you guys close as children?
I was very close to my sister, and then got to that age where there was a lot of tension between us. Then I was probably closer to my brother, Peter. But I always think siblings, it's always fraught with all kinds of dynamics which change from, you know, collusions with different combinations to see, you know, maybe vying for your parents' attention or something like that.
Talking about your parents, you mentioned your dad. What sort of person was he?
My dad was we had a kind of a love-hate relationship, I think. For me, I saw him, he was this very good-looking guy, got on very well with women, got on well with men, very sociable sort of guy, and also had a beautiful voice, beautiful tenor voice, and his ancestors came from Cornwall in Wales. very sort of interesting character, but very sort of feisty as well, could really, you know, turn between, you know, being very sociable to being really kind of aggressive. My father passed away some 15 years ago, and ever since then, I feel like I've manifested, you know, aspects of my dad, particularly sort of to my father was, and this was rare, I think, in the neighborhood I came from. My father was really into clothes and Italian shoes, dressing well, looking sharp. And I think I really inherited that.
Because that's important to you, isn't it?
It really is. And for a long time, I wrestled with it because I thought, oh, that's all very superficial. But it's not, in a way. And what changed me, I heard an interview with Johnny Depp, and he was talking about how he entered characters through the clothes he wore. And I thought, yeah, I really relate to that. I mean, I can actually... The beautiful side to all this, by the way, and I'm a Gemini, so this is kind of a thing that you hear from other, you know, Gemini people, like actors and people like Bob Dylan, that you can completely change your mood by the clothes you wear. And I'm totally like that. You know, I can be sort of grumpy and then I can put on, you know, some other clothes and then I'll be thinking, oh, okay. And it all shifts, you know, the energy shifts. So the idea of going out to perform and putting on a costume really can change me incredibly.
Well, you mentioned about going out and performing, and again, that's something I really want to investigate a little later on in the interview. But going back to your parents, you've told us about your dad. What about mum? What sort of person was your mum?
I think mum was amazing. She was a great stoic sort of woman. She came from a long line. Her ancestors, from what we can trace, and my sister Lynn's done a lot of work on this, is from a place in North Wales called Llangollen by the River Wye, which I haven't been to, but this year I'm hoping to go there. My mum was very much like my father. One of her parents passed away when she was quite young, and she grew up hard, and she grew up hard. She was actually born in a little town called Maree in the very north of South Australia, which used to be on the Garn line between Adelaide and Alice Springs. And her father worked on the railway. So she had a pretty tough life. Mm. Maree is now a ghost town up there because the train doesn't go through there anymore. Very solid, very moral, very ethical woman, very, you know, with strong kind of, you know, religious values. And, you know, loving, supportive, but also, what do you call it, very sort of feisty, but in a different way to Dad, more sort of stoic. She had a sense of sort of morals, and that's the way things were.
Did you get that from her?
To some
degree. What did you get from your mum?
I think what I got from mum is a sense of humour. My mum was always quite funny, and she had a real love of movies. And we didn't know this for a while, but my sister and I were rummaging around in the cupboards one day when mum's out, and we found a book full of black and white photos of Greer Garson, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, and Greta Garbo. We thought, oh, mum's likes the Hollywood film stars. So we started teasing her about that, and you know, realised she had this love of sort of glamour and style as well, and strong women like Katharine Hepburn, you know, who was quite a strong, you know, woman's model, I think, you know, for women of that period. So I think I got a love of, and theatre, because later in life, I think my mum told me when I was younger, what she had wanted to do was to either be a teacher or an actor. And she never got to be a teacher, but what she did get to be was a telephonist, which is back in the old days. You remember from those old Hollywood movies, there's a woman in front of these, switchboards and putting in plugs. And it's a really complicated procedure. Yes, and I used to go and watch her do it. And it was fantastic to watch her answer about 3 calls at once and putting in the plugs and all this stuff. And then the other thing was... her love of theatre manifested as she got older. She went to TAFE and learned to act, and was involved in various amounts of amateur theatre in Adelaide, which eventually she started getting bigger and bigger roles. And then she was in semi-pro theatre. And then she even did some movies. I think she's got a small role in a film called For the Term of His Natural Life,
yes,
based on the Marcus Clarke novel about early Australia. So she got to be convicts walking through mud. And even my dad, you know, who could never remember his lines from any of the little bits and pieces he did, but he would be in these as well. So I think I got that love of theatre and language and a sense of humour.
Hmm. Hmm.
Listen to older voices. Ageless Radio.
I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Robert Lloyd about his early years.
School, was that a good experience for you?
I think at primary school was a pretty good experience, but something happened in me. I got to an age where I was just wanted to rebel. In psychology, they often talk about the second born being the scapegoat, and I think that was kind of my role. My sister was the one who sort of held it all together, and I was the one who rebelled against everything. And I can remember doing things like having my best friend, Robbie Fitzgerald, on a sleepover, and I somehow managed to con him. And the two, as we got up, we got dressed at 3 o'clock in the morning, went up to the local church and crawled up on the roof of the church.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I think maybe we were throwing stones or shooting with little BB guns, the pigeons on the roof. And I think, this is bizarre stuff. And another time, I remember we went to the local mayor was a blacksmith, and we would go run away from school at lunchtime and go and watch him, which was fantastic, putting the horseshoes on horses, and the sparks, the thing of the fire and the red hot iron, and then putting the shoes on horses. And that would matter. And then we found out he had a little secret basement thing. So I can remember another night sneaking out at night and going and sitting in his little, because it was like a dugout. There was nothing sort of there other than this hole. And so we would, roll up cigarettes and sort of sit around and smoke. In fact, there's a scene in that movie, Dead Poets Society, the Peter Weir movie, where all the little kids went off and sat around and read poetry in a circle. And that really reminded me of that experience.
I find that very interesting that we were talking about education and that you've moved into the exploration of the world around you. It's almost as if, for you, you got as much education from your environment and doing things around you than you did in a formal classroom.
I think I did. I was sort of always, I think I've always been fascinated with interesting characters, like this blacksmith character. So various things in your childhood stick out. But I did have periods where I love education. I'm actually a big supporter of education. In fact, I became a teacher, and so I really believe in education, because I had some pretty horrible teachers in my time, but at the same time, I was always educating myself. I'll be buying books on music, or I remember even catching the tram into the city, into Adelaide from Enfield, and buying tiny little books for about 40 cents on Gauguin and Van Gogh, and those yellowy paintings just really almost, I felt like they got me through my childhood, just the sheer beauty of those paintings. And these were really not very good reproductions of them. And I remember I had a terrific teacher in grade 6 in primary school called Mrs. Moffat. And I still remember her name because she was very, very supportive. But at the same time, other experiences like being taken to places like by my parents was good. Like I remember one experience I had on a Christmas. Over Christmas, wonderful things would happen. We'd go down to my auntie Fonny's place, and my dad would play the piano because we couldn't afford a piano, but they had a piano, and dad would play, "Yes, Jesus loves me. Yes, Jesus loves me." And songs and stuff like that. And that was impressive. And my cousins would have all these 45 records, of Elvis and, Bobby V and Crash Craddock and Del Shannon, the Everly Brothers. We'd hang out in their
room. So we're talking late 50s now, are we?
Yeah, we're talking 50s now.
When did you start to appreciate commercial music as opposed to the music in your home that your father and mother may have been involved in? When were you suddenly aware that there was a much broader field of music going on? Do you recall?
I think the first music that sort of started to turn me on to the energy and the rhythm of music was my father had a record player at home, and he had records of big band jazz like Glenn Miller.
Thank you.
that stuff. And the great joy of this was Dad would grab Mum and they would dance around the lounge room to Glenn Miller, the Glenn Miller Orchestra. He had other stuff too. He had Tommy Dorsey, Artie Shaw, maybe Ellington, that kind of stuff. So there was that, which I thought that was great, that stuff, because it made people happy and it made people dance. He also had things. I remember he had a great love of a piece by Franz Liszt called Liebestraum, which was a, you know, very romantic piano piece. And I think my dad was a, you know, closet, you know, wanting to be concert pianist, but he was a fine singer. So that was probably the beginning of it. And then in terms of getting interested in pop music or commercial music, the stuff that really turned me on, I seem to remember an LP record, Buddy Holly's Greatest Hits, I think it was, that my sister had. And I remember being, I think my mum forced my sister to drag your little brother, drag me along to some party where it was in a garage, you know, so there was like cordial and cakes and dancing around to, you know, Buddy Holly. And I remember all that sort of, you know, if you knew Pegasus, then you know why I feel blue about Pegasus, that sort of stuff. My Pegasus. Oh, well, I love you, Kelly. I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue. And I thought, and it was also because he had glasses, you know, because I was forced to wear glasses at the age of 15. I thought, oh, this is good. There's guys out there like, you know, Roy Orbison, Hank B. Marvin, Buddy Holly. These guys are great, and hey, they wear glasses.
Yeah, so it could be cool.
Yeah.
Did secondary school affect your life much, or was that just a transition period?
I think high school really did affect me, possibly in a quite negative way. I was in this sort of transitional space where I think, like all guys of my age, you know, you're discovering of your own sexuality. That becomes like a big issue. Like, you know, can I get a girlfriend? Will I get a girlfriend? Will I ever get kissed? You know, what's going on behind the woodshed? You know, all this sort of stuff. So I hit this point about 15 where I felt so disconnected and isolated from a lot of what was going on around me. And the only way I coped was by becoming this kind of leader. So luckily I had some, you know, leadership skills. So I formed this little kind of gang of people that followed me. So they were like, so I was like, I don't know, some kind of, I guess it probably grew out of the fact that my sister was involved in this dance demonstration group. This is when the Twist first started.
Okay, so we're talking early 60s.
Yeah,
now,
so we're talking like Chubby Checker and Bobby Rydell and Annette Funicello and that sort of stuff. And of course it happened in America years before. It's like, by the time the Mouseketeers and all that stuff got to Australia, you know, they were grown women, you know, on the TV. Yes. They were like, you know, 10-year-olds, you know. So I was in this dance demonstration group with my sister and six other people, and we would go around to, you know, clubs, dancers demonstrating the Twist. So I became sort of this cool person at high school then because I was doing this. So then it shifted. Man, this is a big thing. Maybe I learned that if you're on TV, then, you know, you get girls, or, you know, if you're playing at dances. So I was making, you know, some money out of doing this sort of stuff. So that started, I guess that gave me a lot of confidence, and that helped to, you know, negotiate the idea of having, you know, girlfriends. The other thing that happened was I actually went to school with the woman who became Robin Archer. She used to be called Robin Smith. She was a country and western singer wearing Czech shirts when I knew her. But she directed the Melbourne Festival and I think the Adelaide Festival and did a lot of cabaret stuff, singing Kurt Vile and stuff. And she lives in Melbourne now and does, you know, runs, you know, theatre festivals and stuff. But we were in the same class. But she doesn't like me much because I used to dip her hair in the inkwell while I sat behind her.
I think that was probably a universal activity of most young boys in high school, dipping the, because we still had pens, didn't we?
Yes.
Inkwells in those days.
Yes, we did.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories.
Now, that period from the 50s into the 60s, not just in Australia, but fairly well right through the Western world, was a period of starting of change and upheaval.
Mm.
When, you know, throwing off the shackles of the war years and the shackles of conformity. Did you ever see yourself as rebelling and playing up? Or did you go into that smoothly?
No, it definitely wasn't smooth at all. I was rebelling against sort of everything, really. And I'm not quite sure where it came from, that dynamic. My father was quite a drinker, so I think it might have grown out of tension in the family home and wanting to react against that, or wanting to get my voice heard. And I would do things like I would get my bike, for instance, became some symbol of freedom. I would be, I'd race home from school, you know, after work on my bike, and I'd all sorts of stuff. You know, there was this group called the Skid Kids, you know, and I was in that, and we would sort of ride around, sort of like skidding in people's driveways and making a general nuisance of yourselves. In fact, I was pretty shocking. I did all kinds of stuff, like I ran away from home with a friend of mine, and we rode from Enfield to Gawler, which is like about 20 miles, without lights on our bike. And my plan was to sleep overnight in some old disused railway carriage until my friend who went with me didn't want to do that. So we had started riding back and eventually ended up at the Elizabeth police station, and, you know, our parents having to come down and, you know, pick us up and, you know, drag us home by the ear, or, you know, give us a pretty severe hard time. So yeah, I was rebelling against everything, and it wasn't that kind of rebelling where friends I knew would watch Marlon Brando in The Wild One or see James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause, because I didn't quite relate to that. I felt more like I was a different kind of rebel. I guess one was looking for rebel role models, so I'm not quite sure where it came from. The closest I can think from is I identified a bit with Maynard G. Krebs and the life and love of Dobie Gillis, you know, the guy who won me work. That guy. I saw myself as more like a sort of a beatnik guy who just hung in the corner playing bongos and making the occasional really sort of wisecrack. I think that was sort of more like how I saw myself.
Now, from my first-hand experiences, particularly in Melbourne, that period from 1960 through to 1963, generally anybody who was interested in music was either a jazzer or a rocker. The beatniks had really started to die out by then.
Mm.
Did you fit into either of those categories in that period?
When I first came to Melbourne, how I first came here, just prior to coming to Melbourne, I can't believe that I actually did this, but at the age of 15, I put my own band together, which was like a Rolling Stones, Beatles, Manfred Mann kind of clone band. And I sang from the drums, and we would do songs like, you know, Twist and Shout and those kind of songs. And then I ran my own dance in a town hall. I still can't believe that I did this, but anyway, eventually it got closed down and it was all over. But and then after that, I thought, oh, well, that's it. You know, I've done Adelaide, so I'm moving on. So then I got on my drums on a train, and I knew some people in Adelaide. I knew a guy called Mick Kinnear who had a shop here with some other guys called the Disc Shop, which was a version of a shop that was already in Adelaide. So I came to Melbourne and fell in with these guys, John Pugh, Chris Stockley, and we were in this band, you know, called the Roadrunners. But when I first came here, what amazed me, because it wasn't in Adelaide at all, was this jet trad jazz thing, which was also happening in London. So one of the first gigs I went to, I think it was down in Brighton somewhere, was the Red Onions Jazz Band with Jerry Humphries, Ian Klein, and those guys who eventually became the Loved Ones. And I thought, my God, this is kind of amazing. I couldn't quite work out whether I liked the music or I just thought it was corny and boring. So I don't know whether it was a jazz, and I don't think I was particularly a rocker either. I don't know. I think I had the kind of mind where I wanted to absorb everything and work out whether I liked it later.
Mm.
You know, it's like a smorgasbord. There'd be like all this table full of food, and I think I'll try everything and work out, you know, what I liked later.
That period, it was so intense in terms of the fact that there was some very schmaltzy American 50s stuff being played in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And if you were lucky, the occasional piece of classic music. But then we went from almost nothing to having this absolute avalanche of British music coming in. There was that whole movement, of course, kicked off by the Beatles. Was there any of that music that really kicked you off? Was there any period or any group or any moment where you went, wow?
There was, and it's really hard to sort of pinpoint it because, you know, working on, you know, writing an autobiography at present and also working on a documentary about, you know, my life and work, it's, you really think about this sort of stuff. When I was living in Adelaide before I came here, I remember going to dances, and I think, it's getting to me now. Pre-Beatles, the first things I remember hearing when I went to dances in Adelaide was people like Del Shannon, Gene McDaniels, the Everly Brothers, that kind of music. But the band that really got me were the Shadows. I thought the Shadows were just, as my father would say, the bee's knees.
Join Robert and I next week as we follow him into the 60s in Melbourne. We listen with interest not only to the story behind the story of the developing music scene, but also the story behind the development of a generation. We also find out why and how his writing and composition skills grew. That's next week on Listen to Older Voices with Robert Lloyd. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.